So we will continue with our myth busting and possibly even some myth confirming by looking at a range of different issues. Now, these different kinds of karma rebirth myths are, of course, they, chosen more or less randomly, right? Pramali and I sort of had a chat about it and came up with a list and so on and so forth. So definitely open to anybody has any other questions. We'll go through a few more, but if you have some more myths that you want to be examined or discussed or whatever, but also remember that other things will be talked about as the course goes on. So what we mainly wanted to put here was a few ones which I think are mainly for the reason for putting in them in is because they're like red herrings, and they you end up confusing and wasting a lot of time if you don't sort of deal with them up front. Okay, so the next one. In-between state. Is there an in-between state? Is there no in-between state? So for those of you who are not familiar with this particular issue, the Buddha said, okay, you die and you get reborn somewhere, right? So then the question is, well, how does that actually happen? What's the process? And these suttas are not nearly so clear about that particular detail. There are some things, but it's not so obvious. And there was a discussion in the early Buddhist community about this particular issue. And most schools of Buddhism believed that there was some kind of process that you went from one lifetime to another following some kind of path or pattern. Whereas some schools, and especially the Theravadan school in Sri Lanka, had the idea that there is no in-between state. So there's basically one life finishes and the next life starts again in the next mind moment, literally. So literally the next instant. There's not even a moment of a passage from one to the other. And so which one is true? Well, in this particular case, I think it's the suttas it's not obvious what the sutta, if it was usually these things, if they're obvious in the suttas, then there wouldn't be a discussion about it later on. But even though the suttas aren't particularly obvious, I still think that they're clear enough in the idea that there is some kind of process from one life to the next. And there are multiple passages that talk about this in several different kinds of ways. The best known passage is in the Metta Sutta. It says, Bhuta va sambhavesi va. And Bhuta is those beings who have been reborn. And sambhavesi means those who are to be born, right? Or who are on the way to being reborn. And so that sambhavesi is clearly like an implication that there's some kind of process going on there. And we find multiple other passages that confirm a similar kind of idea. For example, one kind of Buddha discusses various kinds of anagamis or non-returners. And of these kinds of non-returners, these are people who attain to a very high level of Dhamma, but they're not yet completely fully enlightened, right? And so the Buddha gives a simile. He says some of those who are non-returners, they will die, but they will antara parinibbaya, right? They will attain parinibbana in between, right? And what does that mean by in between? And the simile is given like you strike a piece of hot metal with a hammer and a spark flies off. And that spark flies off, but it cools down in between before it lands. Yeah. So this is the idea that you die and you cool down, i.e. become enlightened, parinibbaya, parinibbayati, in the space in between. So you die as a non-returner, but you became an arahant before you get reborn. Yeah? So this is found a few places in the suttas. And there are some other places also where it talks about similar kinds of ideas. Now, also if you look at how the Buddha used similes, I think this is one of the most striking things about the way that the Buddha talked about rebirth is how he used similes. And if those of you who are familiar with the suttas will know that the Buddha was a fantastic simile giver, right? He was very precise and very careful, and the suttas are full of very striking images. And you know, each time that the Buddha gives these metaphors, it's always like, wow, it's just the right image for that particular thing. You know, the Buddha was so good at choosing those images. And when he's talking about rebirth, he will always give an image which is something like some kind of process. So a classic example is in the description of the divine eye, the psychic power of seeing beings dying and being reborn according to their karma, power of clairvoyance. And the Buddha, the simile that the Buddha uses there is, he said, it's like a man who's standing on an upper story balcony in a village, and he's looking down on the street below, and he sees people walking out of one house, walking along the road and walking into another house, and somebody else walking out of this house and walking along and walking into another house. So clearly the whole purpose of that simile is to emphasize the fact that there's a journey involved, there's a process, right? The Buddha could have very easily given a simile like, say, someone walking from one room of a house into another room, right? If he wanted to emphasize the fact that there's no, you know, it's an immediate transition, he would have given a simile to emphasize that. But it's clearly it's this idea that there's the houses, which is the nivasa, and actually the word in Pali for past lives, or one of the words in Pali for past lives, is pubbe nivasa. Right, so recollecting past lives is pubbe nivasa nusati jnana, is the knowledge of recollection of past, literally dwellings or houses. Okay, that's your so that's the idiom that they use. So this coming out of your nivasa, which is your life or house, and then moving down the road and going into other places. So this is the idea that most of the early Buddhist schools had. And I think the Theravada school rejected it, not for any particular good reason, but I think they were a bit paranoid about the idea of a self. And I won't go too long to the early Abhidhamma discussions, but I think that they were kind of afraid that it sounded a bit kind of self-like, a bit like a kind of soul or something. And so they were like, no, we don't have any souls here, go away. But actually it's a kind of misplaced kind of thing. So that's the sutta. So then from experience, and then what does experience say? Well, of course, you're all familiar with the descriptions of things like near-death experiences and so on, right? And people always have, the description is always of some kind of process, right? It's not like you just vanish here and then reappear somewhere else, but you undergo a journey or a process. And that's not just, you know, those near-death experiences, but that's also just, to me, it's just common sense. Actually, change is always process, right? I mean, if you ask a doctor, when does death occur, right? There's no moment of death, yeah? There's a process of dying, yeah? And it's always somewhat arbitrary to be able to draw a line and say, well, before this they were alive and after that they're dead, right? Actually, it's an ongoing process. And change is always a process, right? So, you know, again, the Buddhist way of looking at things is always to look at what are those things that we do know, and then we can infer from what we do know towards things that we don't know. So this is a kind of empirical or analogical method. So I think also from that method, it also seems to me very likely that there is some kind of in-between state. Probably in-between state is maybe not the best word for it, maybe in-between process, right, or path. And that path is probably variable for different people, I imagine, right? So some people, maybe it's quite swift, right? If you have like strong karma that's sending you to be reborn somewhere or whatever, probably happens pretty much straight away. Somebody else maybe lingers on and decides, I'm going to stay here and annoy my relatives for as long as possible, right? I'm going to get my revenge, yeah? And yeah, some people really do think like that. We had a case in Perth last year. This is the husband and father threatened the family, threatened that he's got like a 12, 14-year-old daughter, threatened her, I'm going to die and I'm going to come back and haunt you. Yeah, it's very funny, isn't it? Then he committed suicide. Yeah, they were pretty freaked out. So, yeah, I went to their home and did some blessings and stuff, holy water. More holy water. So I think, you know, if your karma is unclear or confused or your mind is messed up when you die, you don't really know that you're dead and so on, then maybe that process is going to be confused. You know, think about moving home, right? So sometimes you might move home and it's a very straightforward process. You just take your bags out of one house and then move and put it in another house, right? But that's fairly rare, isn't it? Yeah. Usually it's a lot more complicated. Usually, you know, you're getting the financing and then moving things in and out, and you've got to stay in some relatives' home for a while and then and back and forth, and it's a complicated process. So that's just a house, right? So imagine an actual whole life is even more complicated than that.
Is this a good time to ask about out-of-body experiences, sort of
okay.
similar to the near-death, isn't it?
Seems to be similar, yeah.
What is there any, people report that, but I mean, what do you think there's anything, I suppose there's something going on in the mind that gives them that sensation of looking down on themselves.
Right, yeah. See, that's right. So in one of the things to notice about those experiences that most people sort of miss, you see, we tend to think of that as, you know, if you're out of your body, it's like your mind is out of your body, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe if you come from a theistic perspective, you say it's like your soul or something like that. But how does your mind or your soul see?
Mm.
Right? Seeing involves light. That's photons. And photons, in order to be able to see something with photons, they have to actually hit something, right? You can't just magically see with a disembodied mind, right? You actually have to have an eye or something, if not an eye, right? So in Buddhism, you have this idea, the Buddha talked about the physical realm in two aspects or two ways. One he called olarika rupa and the other one sukuma rupa. Olarika means coarse, so olarika rupa is kind of heavy matter, right? This kind of stuff
right.
that you can hit. And then there's sukuma rupa, which is subtle matter. And so it's not really defined very clearly, but maybe you think about it in terms of energies or something like that, okay? So that when somebody has an out-of-body experience, okay, it's not that there's no rupa there, there's no physical dimension to what's happening. There is a physical dimension to it, but that's the sukuma rupa. Now, what that is, I can't really say, right? I don't really know. But there's something physical about that. So there's something to, like, interact with light and so on and so forth so that those experiences can happen. Yeah.
It reminds me of someone describing the fact that she nearly died after having a baby.
Right.
And she talked about a tunnel and a light at the end.
Yeah.
And for her, I mean, she was there talking to us.
Yep.
Years later. But I just wonder if there's something going on in the brain that might explain that perception.
Yeah, well, so the question is whether there's something that in your brain that can explain those perceptions about near-death experiences and so on and so forth. I mean, they're also very similar sometimes to some meditation experiences, right? You feel very light, you feel, you know, you see the brilliant radiance and feel very blissful and so on. And people I know some people who've had both profound meditation experiences and near-death experiences, and they say that they are very, very similar.
Right.
It's not easy to prove experimentally whether these things are just a brain function or not. Essentially, to be able to prove it, you have to be able to show that a person's brain is dead at the time when they have that experience. So in order to really prove it, now there's been a few cases when people have said that they have been able to do that. People have been brain dead when certain things have happened. Yeah, but it's not an easy experiment to replicate, as you could understand. Finding volunteers is a little bit tricky, right? You can't when you're wording the consent form, you have to be. There's no room for ambiguity and so on. I consent to brain death. Yes. So this is why it's still. But I do believe that there are some studies along those lines, which give some interesting results. Yeah.
So you think that to have that kind of experience, you have to be practically brain dead.
I'm not saying that you have to be brain dead to have the experience. I'm saying you have to be brain dead in order to be able to empirically know that it's not just a brain phenomenon.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's the tricky part. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Barbara.
In some of the studies, like Stevenson's studies, where he looked at reincarnation in Indian communities and would seeing evidence of a child who'd come back into the same family.
Right.
That would seem to indicate a sort of, you know, holding pattern thing.
Right.
Well, so that if karma is such that the individual is going to come back into the same, there obviously has to be an opportunity. There has to be pregnancy. It has to so right. Rather than being born somewhere completely different, there seems to be some process, if in fact this is true, that will kind of leave that entity waiting for the right opportunity. Is there anything that the suttas about?
Yeah, again, the suttas don't talk about that in detail, but I think you're quite right, you know, and it does seem to be for most people the default pattern is that you tend to get reborn in a similar place, right, in that same family or village or district. And the cases when people get reborn somewhere completely different are relatively fewer. It does happen, but relatively fewer. There's usually some connection. And but as you know quite rightly point out, you know, the conditions have to be there, right? And if you might have all the karmic affinity to be reborn into this particular family, but if no one's getting pregnant, well, there's nothing really you can do about that, right? Maybe you get reborn as a cat or something like that. So these things, like, you know, again, this is the thing that karma is not determining everything. Karma is working with all of the other complexities of life. Yeah. But I think that is also quite right, that you know, you can't just expect that all the conditions are just going to be. I mean, it's realistically, it seems very weird, doesn't it, that the idea that at that moment that you die, if there was a moment that you die, which actually there isn't, right, that right then there is a conception taking place at that moment. But, of course, conception isn't something that takes place in a moment either, right? So, anyway. Justin?
The other schools talk in a lot of detail about the Bardo sects.
Right.
How did this come about?
Yeah, well, there's a long history of that. I mean, you can see it's quite a fascinating subject, right? So this is one of the things in the Theravadan school, because they kind of squashed the conversation to begin with, right? So then there's no real discussions about it. I should just point out that even though it's kind of the official Theravadan doctrine that we don't believe in the in-between state, okay? If you want to be a good Theravadan, which I failed at many years ago, but I mean, that's a discussion which is found in the Theravadan Abhidhamma book, the Kathāvatthu, and you can read the discussion if you want to look at it in more detail. But actually, lots of Theravadan monks don't actually believe that. For example, like the Thai forest tradition monks basically all believe in an in-between state, right? So even though they're sort of officially Theravadan, but they don't sort of pass the Theravadan right view test on that and many other issues. But so I think that it's, you know, once you've accepted that there is that process involved, then I think it's natural that there would be speculation about it, there would be discussion about it. And of course, you know, you've got communities of people, they're meditators and things, and they're having these kinds of experiences. So the main discussions that we have are from the Sarvasivadin school, which is the ones that were inherited by the Tibetans. And Sarvasivadin and Mula Sarvasivadin texts already give some quite detailed discussions of these things, even the Indian texts. I'll talk about them in quite some detail. One of the tendencies you find with Sarvasivada, this is one of the early schools of Buddhism, is that Sarvasivada means everything exists, right? And it means the past, present, and future all exist, as opposed to the Theravadins always just like the present only exists. So the Sarvasivadins like to sort of stretch time out. Yeah, so time is all, everything's always longer in Sarvasivada, right? So they stretched out that in-between process. And then sort of talked about it in a lot of detail and described it in a lot of detail. And so you find this in their Abhidharma texts, like the Abhidharma Kosha and other things like that. Yeah.
In what state would you exist if there is an in-between state?
How do you exist? Well, think about what happens, right? When somebody describes that experience, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say take a classic near-death experience, right? So the first thing is you feel that you're rising up out of the body and you're looking down and you see your body there, right? So obviously there's some form there, right? There's some physical presence of some kind because you have a location, okay? You have sight. These are physical qualities, right? You can't have location if there's nothing physical there, right? So there must be rupa khanda of some kind, yeah? Again, this is a sukuma rupa, a subtle form. But again, and then they say that they rise out of the body, they're floating there, and they feel very blissful, right? They feel very happy and peaceful. It's Vedana Khanda, yeah? Then what do? You see a bright light, right? Yeah, and often people will see and they'll recognize the relatives who might come to see them and greet them, yeah, and so on. So this is Sanyakanda, right? It's perception and recognition. Yeah? Then you have to make a choice, right? Am I going to keep going or am I going to come back? Right? And that's, of course, we only hear the stories from the ones who came back, right? But the choice, what choice do you make? This is Sankara Kanda. This is volition, right? That's your choice, yeah? And all of that is always described by the people who have that experience. It's always described as being very, very clearly aware, right? That it is not, it's not a kind of murky, dreamlike state or anything like that. It's very, very clearly aware. And this, of course, is Vijnana Kanda, is consciousness, awareness. So if you look at those near-death experiences, they're actually described not just vaguely, right? They're described precisely in terms of the five khandhas. Yeah.
But then it's yourself. You haven't let go of yourself. So you refer to yourself. Is there,
I have no idea what that question meant.
So if it's yourself.
Instead of you who's looking at it.
Yeah.
Sorry? What?
Self is still there. The person that I call I,
yeah,
is still in existence. Because you're looking.
Well, it's no more or less in existence than it was beforehand. I'm not gonna be trapped into asserting or denying the existence of a self. But yeah, your feeling of yourself and your identity is just the same, yeah. Yeah.
What was just said about, you know, if you're sort of meant to go into a particular situation, maybe you have affinity with relatives or whatever, and there's no opportunity, so is it possible for someone to hover in an in-between state to say 4 years until they get reborn in a particular
maybe. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, there seem to be some stories that that's the case, but it's hard to know.
Space-time could be very different in different realms, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, this is something that... I should repeat the question. Lucy's talking about the amount of time you can spend in that space and whether time is relative. And actually, that's one of the things which is talked about explicitly in the early suttas. And I believe it might be the earliest place where it actually has this idea of, like, the relativity of the flow of time. Yeah, so the time in the heaven realms and other realms flows very differently than it does here on Earth. Yeah, I mean, that's a very sophisticated idea, but yeah, you find it in the suttas. Yeah.
In those states, one's still conditioned, so does that mean that the ego and all those attachments that we have would still be present?
Absolutely, yeah. So the ego, everything is still present in the in-between process, probably better than in-between state, which is why in those traditions which have had the belief in that, like in the Tibetan tradition and so on, there's always the... teaching, right? So you actually have somebody there to teach somebody and try to guide them through that process. Yeah, because you can actually, you know, ideally even avoid getting reborn or at least direct yourself to a good rebirth through that process.
Sorry, but we don't say that the so-called ego of this life is exactly the same in the Vata. We say a kind of base consciousness or a consciousness in its most simple form will remain and then gradually change as karmic forces drive it towards another kind of rebirth. Like, for example, if we have the karma to be reborn as an animal, in the beginning we'll have more of an awareness of a human being, but then as the 49 days progress, or however long it is, sometimes it's very quick depending on karma, the consciousness will become grosser and grosser and be driven more towards the rebirth in that direction. Like at a train station or something, you know, and you're catching a train
of
the next life.
Yeah. But it actually evolves during that process.
And
yeah.
Everything you perceive is simply a projection of your own mind. It's not an inherently existing state. You're driven by your own karmic conditioning and perceptions and fears, you know. Doesn't mean that the Vata is a real state. It's simply your own mind.
You mentioned that kind of basic level of consciousness. Is that the alaya vijnana?
I don't know what they would call that. You know, we don't. That's more of a term they use in the Zen school, in the mind-only school.
Okay.
Honestly, don't know. They call it mind stream. You know.
That's probably what they call alaya vijnana. Yeah, that's the mind-only.
I don't think we that would be fully the correction, but I don't know. I don't know.
Why would that not be?
Because Tibetan Buddhists are always trying to avoid this mind-only school, saying there is mind. You know, we say there is mind, but mind itself is empty.
Sure.
So I don't have enough philosophical training.
Okay.
To know.
Okay. Yeah. Sure.
Usually when people go through the dying process, they're in a hospital and they'll be pumped full of morphine and various other drugs. So I guess my question is two kind of parts. The one part would be, can that give us the perception that we're having these out-of-body experiences? And I guess the other one would be, does that distort our entry into the Bardo or distort the in-between state, whatever that might be?
Okay, so the first question is, could that be mistaken? I'm not sure if that could be, if drug experiences could be mistaken for the Bardo experiences. I don't know. I doubt it personally. Yeah.
Anecdotally, I've read people explaining psychedelic experiences that are very similar to what you were talking about.
Sure, but those psychedelic drugs are quite different from the morphine that people are taking in hospital. Yeah.
I've heard some
hallucinations.
And
patients typically used for cancer.
Right.
Morphine
doesn't
induce.
Morphine can have some pretty serious
hallucinations.
Yes, it can do.
Maybe. Yeah. Look, I'm not entirely sure, but yeah. Sorry, Maria, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I have read a book of the death experience who a neurosurgeon happens to have this near-death experience.
Okay.
And he describes the experience in his book, and in the end, he analyzes all these kind of hypotheses. Can it be drug induced? Can it be brain induced? Can it be this? Can it be that? And to all these hypotheses, he says, no, can't. So I just don't remember his name, but if I remember, I would go to
If you remember, you can put it on the forum.
Yeah.
And people would be interested to read that. So that's another good thing that we can put on the forum there. If anyone has some good references, books, YouTube videos, anything like that, talking about these questions, then you can put it there, and then other people can share those as well. But to come to your second question about does the having painkillers affect your rebirth? Well, no, not really. Because what determines your rebirth is not your state of consciousness, right? It's your karma, okay? So it's what your choice is. So the fact that your mind is blurry and so on and so forth doesn't really matter. What matters is your choice. So if you're taking the choice to take those drugs because you want to get off on the drugs, then that's your karma, right? On the other hand, if you're just sitting there and suffering from pain and you just want to be released from pain, then that's not any bad karma because you just want some pain relief, yeah? So it's really about what is your intention in doing that. Yeah. So I wouldn't you know, don't be afraid if you're in hospital, if your relatives are in hospital and they need some pain relief, that's fine, okay?
Is rebirth the same as reincarnation?
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay.
We usually use the term rebirth to explain it from a Buddhist point of view, but it's basically the same kind of idea, except in Hinduism they use the idea of a soul. So in Buddhism, we don't talk about a soul, we talk about consciousness. Yeah. Man.
How important is it? How important is your last state of mind determining your future?
Ah, this is one of our next myths that I'll get onto if we can finish these questions. Yes, we'll get back to that. Any others? Let's move on. Okay, so I think we can say, what do you reckon? Busted. Okay, very good. Next one. Rebirth is only psychological, okay? So this is this idea that the Buddha didn't really teach about rebirth, and that when we talk about states of rebirth, heaven and hell, heaven is just like a happy place in your mind, hell is just like a sad place in your mind, and so on and so forth. And before addressing that, just to reflect a little bit about the nature of these things in Buddhism, and psychology, how that relates to metaphor and cosmology and so on. One of the things which is fundamental in the Buddhist cosmological system is that all of the states of rebirth, all the different realms of existence and so on, are generated by your mind, Okay? So your mind is the formative force, right? So if you don't think of it like, say, that God or the universe or something made these things and they're somehow there, right? They are things which is just, they're just states or whatever they are, but they're produced by consciousness, okay? They're produced by karma, they're produced by the mind, right? So this is really important to understand. Now, so to say something is only psychological, right, is just wrong-headed from the beginning, from a Buddhist point of view, right? Because the mind is the most important, powerful creative force in the whole universe. It's not like it's only created by the mind. It's not merely created by the mind. It is created by the mind, right? Because the mind is the creative force in the universe. Right? So what we find, because all of these states are produced by the mind, then, of course, they parallel things that's happening in your mind. So, of course, good states in your mind parallel the idea of people's heavens, and bad states parallels the idea of hells and so on and so forth. That's what they are, right? That's precisely what they are. Just like in this world that we live in today, we create realities around us, okay, based on our mind, okay? So we think of our beautiful home I want to create, and so we go, we build a lovely house and we make a lovely garden and we raise a lovely family and everybody's happy, and we've created a heaven for ourselves because our mind has been heavenly, right? Or we go and we decide, I'm going to build a lot of guns and bombs and going to shoot people and so on. We create a hell because we've had a hell in our mind, right? And so we actually create realities because of that, and that's the world that we live in, right? But that doesn't mean that that's only psychological, right? You don't go to the victims of a killing in wartime and say, oh, you weren't really killed because this was only a psychological state in the mind of the gun, the shooter who was killing you, right? Yeah. So this idea that somehow you can point to a parallel between the cosmology and the psychology and therefore just assume that you can reduce one to the other, okay? Right? This is completely groundless. The whole point of it is that our internal reality and the external reality mirror each other, right? They're co-creating, because of course it's not one way, right? Our mind creates the external world, but you don't just wish for something and it's there, right? The external world has also got its conditions and its constraints and so on. So it's actually an interplay, right? Which we're constantly working with, right? But so even though the conditionality comes from both sides, but the most important side, the one that we can have some control over and the one which ultimately is liberating, is what we can come from inside, right? That's, again, the intention. So that's where the karma is coming from. That's the important constructive force, right? So if we look and see what the suttas say, what they talk about these things, then you know, it's very clear. Basically, anybody who reads what the suttas say about these, with a kind of, you know, if you're not reading it from an incredibly programmatic point of view, it's completely obvious that these things are meant to be, you know, states of rebirth and so on. They're not just psychological states, and there are plenty of contexts where it makes those differences quite explicit and very clear. And it also acknowledges the limits that we can have in knowing and understanding these things. A good example is one of the suttas, which is in one of the readings coming up later on. And just if I can recall the sutta off the top of my head, but the Buddha's talking to Senapati, the general Siha. And Siha asks the Buddha about generosity and says, you know, what are the benefits of being generous? And the Buddha gives him five benefits for being generous, right? He says, being generous, if you're generous, you feel happy in yourself and you have a good reputation and you feel confident when you're in groups of people and something, I can't remember what they all are. And the last one, it says that you go to a good rebirth, you get reborn in heaven, okay? But Siha's answer to that was very interesting. Siha said, well, that first benefit that you say about generosity, I can confirm that from my own experience, because I'm a generous person and I've practiced generosity and I've seen that benefit for myself. And so too with the second and third and fourth benefits of generosity that you've talked about. But that last one, where you say that somebody who's generous gets to get reborn in heaven, I can't confirm that for myself, okay? Because I haven't got that ability, yeah? So I'll just have to take that on trust. Yeah? And so the Buddha says, okay, sure, you just have to take that on trust, yeah? So you see, he's clearly making a distinction. If heaven was merely a psychological state of happiness, then of course he would have been able to see it, just as he saw all those other things. But these things, you know, it always says, or very frequently it says, you know, kayasa beheda paramarana, with the breaking up of the body after death, and then one goes to the heaven realm and so on. So it's very clear from the suttas that these states of rebirth are meant as actual, like, abodes of consciousness, is what one of the terms that's used, vijnana titi, is the abodes of consciousness. So now the problem is, and you know, we shouldn't gloss over these issues, but the problem is, what exactly, if they're not just psychological, what exactly are they, right? And that's something which is much harder to explain. I mean, we have the human realm and we have the animal realm, and they seem, you know, okay, if they're all right, we can understand those realms. But what about all these heaven realms and so on? Where are they? If we'd asked traditional Buddhists, 100 or 200 years ago, or even these many of them today, and you say, where is heaven? Where is hell? They'd say it's down there. It's in the earth, yeah? And, well, you know, hell's like, you know, boiling pots of lead and things like that. It's not actually that dissimilar to what's actually happening underground, right? And where is heaven? Heaven's up there. Well, we've flown up there now, and we have all these satellites and stuff which are taking photos and things all the time. You'd think they would have noticed, right? And all of these telescopes, and we've seen lots and lots of things, right? I was looking this the other day, photos of quasars from 6 billion light years away, right? But we haven't seen any heavens, right, so far. So where are they? So then, you know, when we talk about that, then usually we say something like, oh, you know, they're in another dimension or something like that. Of course, that doesn't really mean anything, right? It's just a word that we use to say we think it's there, but we can't see it, okay? Maybe it's one of these things in, like, string theory, right? There's, like, 11, is there 11 dimensions now? String theory, I think it's 11, there's 11 dimensions. So maybe heaven's packed up in one of those 11 dimensions somewhere. I don't know. So, you know, I think we have to admit that question to me is pretty much open-ended. I don't really know what these states are in terms of any physical reality. But certainly I don't think that we can reduce them to just a psychological state. Over to you. Questions? Yes.
Now, you said rebirth.
Yeah.
Is it a physical rebirth, like you were born?
Yep.
Or you said rebirth is a moment-to-moment consciousness?
No. There's no moment-to-moment rebirth. That should be on one of the myths. No, this is just a. When the Buddha was talking about rebirth, he always talking about rebirth in terms of you die and you get reborn in a different realm. Yeah, the idea of moment-to-moment rebirth is purely a 20th century invention. Yeah.
I don't have a problem with the fact that we don't know where heavens are, simply from the point of view that we don't know where most of the universe is anyway. And if there are any scientists in there, please tell me otherwise. My understanding is that the physical realm that we can see accounts for 4% of what exists in the universe. Then there's dark matter,
right,
which is something like another 20%.
Right.
And then there's dark energy, which is another, whatever the balance is, 75, 76% energy. And the only reason we know it's there is because it's been inferred. So we don't have the equipment or the complexity or whatever it is we need to know what 96% of the universe is anyway. We infer it from quantum mechanics and this, that, and the other. So the fact that I don't know and can't see where heaven and hell is just means I'm not equipped with the ability to detect it. So
right.
I don't really worry about it. There's so much stuff we don't know.
Right.
Why on earth would we assume that we would know where it was anyway?
Mm. Yeah.
In the suttas, the descriptions of heavens are very particular and quite specific in terms of what one expects, such as a new house or a mansion or what have you. So,
yeah,
does that make a more contemporary understanding of the universe challenge those?
Okay. I'll come to that in just 1 second, just to riff off that thing of this is completely probably apropos of nothing, but I was just reminded of when we were doing the conference in Hamburg, and some of you probably heard this story, but doing this Bhikkhuni conference, and then the Dalai Lama was being introduced by the chancellor of the university or something like that, and they were talking about how the same kind of thing, that we're constantly finding things that we don't know, right, and that our universe is expanding and we're living in this world. And he said that, you know, then our scientists have shown that 90% of the university is made of dark matter. Which was a bit of a Freudian slip, but anyway. So, Simon, to come back to that. Okay, so in terms of the description, so the point is that there are certain places in the suttas, which are fairly rare, but there are one or two places in the suttas where it talks about the heavens and the hells in more detail, and we'll have a look at some of those passages later in the course. And that they do seem to be very kind of vivid and concrete, and that there's like these kind of places where these, you know, you have mansions, you have like Mahamoggallana shaking the palace of Sakya and things like that with his big toe. So yes, there are those passages. However, this is something that we discussed in our conversation with Bhikkhu Bodhi. So I think maybe you find that in the transcript of the interview with Bhikkhu Bodhi, if I remember correctly. We would distinguish between two kinds of statements which are found in the suttas, okay? And a good example of these two kinds of statements is in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, right? The Buddha's first sermon. In the core Dhamma teachings there, in the Four Noble Truths, right? It talks about rebirth, right? Yayang dangha bono bhavika, right? It's that craving which gives rise to future rebirth, right? That's the second noble truth. So rebirth is talked about, but it's talked about purely in kind of abstract and philosophical terms. Right? And then you come to the end portion of the sutta, where it then says, and the Chatu Maharadika Deva, the four great kings, took up the cry and said the Buddha taught the Dhamma, and so on. It goes up through the different realms of gods. And there you find the kind of the mentions of the classes of gods according to the Indian cosmology and so on and so forth. And it's fairly obvious reading the sutta that these are two quite different kinds of things, right? I mean, for a start, the cosmological section, the cries of the devas, is not actually attributed to the Buddha, right? It's only the first part, the Four Noble Truths, which is, the sutta says, this is what the Buddha said, right? This other bit is sort of tacked on at the end without a particular author. And also, if you look at it text critically, there is a problem of, what do they call it, resumptive reduplication. Is a text critical thing where you see the it's like a narrative flow thing, right? So the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta goes to where Kandanya understands the Dhamma, right? Then it has all the cries of the devas and so on, long, long, long passage, and then it has the Buddha saying, "Oh, Kandanya has understood the Dhamma." Yeah? So it actually looks very much like that whole section has just been stuck there in the middle. And in fact there's multiple versions of that sutta, about 17, probably 20 or so versions of that particular sutta, and all of them present that in different ways in quite a lot of places, versions that isn't there or it's presented in a different way or something like that. So again, when we were talking with Bhikkhu Bodhi, we sort of, you know, made this distinction between the discussions of rebirth, which are presented in a philosophical sense, like in the Four Noble Truths and Dependent Origination and so on. And in those contexts, it tends to be very general, and it's the idea of rebirth is there, but not these kind of sort of Indian cosmological details. And then there are those sort of the narrative portions, which are usually not attributed to the Buddha, and that's where we find the more sort of culturally informed passages and so on. So obviously we'd be much less inclined to take those things literally than we would the philosophical passages. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's the literal passages that kind of inspire people to practice, isn't it?
Depends who it is and what kind of practice they're doing. Yeah.
This could be the gods, or you know, you could reach the level of the Brahma gods or higher.
Right.
At the end of your life.
Can be, yeah.
And keep trying.
Yeah.
You're on your deathbed and you've got this stage, keep trying for a higher.
Right.
So it's kind of like in terms of his head. It's not just a psychological event. So if they're not meant to be interacting literally, then how should one interact? Well,
I would honestly, those things, I would interpret them as being storytelling. Basically, being metaphor.
I wonder if Ayurveda is too, because in the Tibetan tradition there's a lot of emphasis on the various heavenly realms and what's happening in them. Are they mentioned each other literally, or are they storytelling?
Did everyone hear his question?
The question Simon asked Ayesha about the heaven realms and in Tibetan tradition, whether they're meant to be interpreted literally because there's many, got lots of details and complexity in those realms talked about there.
So you're more or less saying that you think it's not authentic Buddhism and it's added on
there? I'm just thinking that whether the names of gods are all Indian names, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whether they, all of these kind of, the 500 pink-footed nymphs who are there and all of these kinds of things. I'm not particularly inclined to take those things literally.
Right.
So, yeah. But the principle of rebirth into different realms and so on is what I think is more important.
So your question is if we think it's literally true in Tibetan Buddhism?
I'm interested in knowing
how it's understood.
Do they physically exist? Are they places that we've got?
Well, I mean, even in the Theravada and Abhidhamma, the way they talk about it is pretty specific, right? It's this many leagues and
right. Yeah.
So, but we, I think we pretty much accept that it exists, and it describes in our Abhidhamma the existence of those realms, and it might even give location. And we have all kinds of strange ideas about how Mount Sumeru is this high, and on top of it is the Deva realm, and at the base is such and such,
right.
And four countries, which actually correspond with ancient Indian land, maps of India, but I think most lamas and most practitioners know that this is that these realms are a projection of the mind, they have some relative existence, but in terms of, it being in the sky or something like that. I mean, the main thing that is that it's a perception of the mind, that it's conditioned by the mind. Although from our point of view, those people are born in those realms. In terms of actually having a physical location, I don't think we worry too much about that. We just think mostly it's in the mind of the being. But because, I know a lot of modern Buddhists say, well, hell is just in your mind and heaven is just in your mind. But as far as we're concerned, the perception of a hell being who has so much suffering, it's a lot more than that, because the amount of pain a human being can take before they go unconscious, a hell being would have more capacity for that, but they're born and conditioned by their karma. So I think our view is not that different to a traditional Theravada in terms of accepting that those things exist. But most modern teachers more or less say that those realms are, the way people perceive it is very much according to the conditioning of their mind.
But that's not even just a modern development, is it? I mean, that's intrinsic in the whole Yogacara and Madhyamaka discussions of reality and consciousness.
But Bhante, there are some Tibetan lamas who are actually still teaching that the earth is flat and won't allow the monks to study science. and I'm sure there's some monasteries like that in Burma too, so...
But it's important.
I'm sure. Interesting detail that I noticed a number of years ago, one of the writings of Vasubandhu. So he's a Yogacara philosopher about 4th century, and he's talking about the question of whether the world is sort of inherently existent or whether it's just a projection of the mind, right? So he's talking about that in general, right? And one of the arguments that he uses to establish that, okay?
Mm.
So this isn't a question that he's arguing for. This is something that he's assuming that everybody knows and agrees and takes for granted, okay? He says just like for somebody in hell, then the hell beings are all just projections of the mind, then the same thing is true in the world that we live in, that it's all just projections of the mind. Yeah. I mean, that's oversimplifying as a very subtle argument. But it was interesting that, you know, even writing in the 4th century, he basically took it for granted that people would see these things in psychological, you know, as a psychological projection. Again, it's not to say that they don't exist, but just to say that they're mind creation. Yeah. Yeah.
If a hell realm, for instance, is basically a projection of the mind of the person who's dying, they would all be separate. I mean, they'd be a separate phenomenon. You could meet your friends there in any real sense. You might project them there in your imagination, right, or in imagination, but you wouldn't actually encounter each other. So the question is, does everybody go to the same realm? Or is there a realm for every individual?
Yeah, it's very hard when you start poking these things in detail. I mean, generally, it seems to be assumed that it's something more or less like the human realm or animal realm, where there is a sort of a presence of a realm somehow, which you know, your karma kind of interacts with that. So there's kind of an individual. But it may be the case in some cases that it is just purely individually projected. Yeah, but that's another. You know, it's not an obvious question at all. Yeah.
But on those kind of levels of logic, you could also say, would you recognize your friend if they were born as a cockroach? Like, they're still there, you're still there, but you're both really different. So your perception has been altered. So it doesn't mean to say that you're not inhabiting the same space, but your perception is radically different.
But I suppose what I mean is, if you've created it from your karma, or if it has been created from karma, how could they meld with someone else's, another creation? It would be a very individual creation. So and every karmic creation would be an individual thing. They wouldn't join together.
Tibetan Buddhists describe the term communal karma.
Which is one of the myths we're going to talk about later on.
Can't wait.
Okay, maybe let's just do some meditation for a few minutes, and before continuing on with our myth busting.